Rapid expansion?
We're ready.
Worker shortage?
We're good.
Anything can change the world of work.
A celebrity buys the company.
Depends on who it is. But relax, we've got ADP.
From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
What to make of the inflation numbers as the House votes to let congressional staff unionize? And Elon Musk says President Trump will be welcome to rejoin Twitter. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Kate Batchelder-Odell. We talked yesterday about President Biden's inflation speech, but now we have these fresh numbers from the Labor Department. So let's quickly go over what they say. In April, prices rose 8.3% year over year. That's down slightly from the 8.5% reported for March. But Kim, on the other hand, the analysts had expected something more. They'd expected 8.1%. So what do you make of these figures?
Yeah, I think these figures are, Houston, we have a big problem because they were thinking things were going to go down. The thing that is really jumping out at everyone today is core prices. Those are prices that exclude food and fuel. They were up 0.6% month on month, which was double from March, which it was 0.3%. So this is a scary thing. It also, you're finally beginning to hear people talk about something that we have expressed alarm on this podcast for a number of months now, but you are hearing economists say maybe we're really in a wage price spiral. And that is a scary situation for the Fed. That is a situation where, because of a labor shortage, you are seeing employers have to pay their people more money in higher wages, also more benefits. But then that money is out there. And in order to cover the costs, companies are raising their prices, which then makes workers ask for more money. And you get into this horrible circular loop. And you are hearing people now say that this seems to be where we are. And the big question is going to be, how does the Fed tamp this down without throwing us into a recession?
The other thing that jumped out at me from these numbers is that much of the decline appears to have come from gasoline energy prices. According to these numbers from the Labor Department, the monthly change in gasoline prices, it was down 6.1%. in April. But as we know, there was a slight easing of those gasoline prices, and now we're back up to record levels at the pump. And so, Kate, that also suggests that some of the decrease here was temporary and it might not hold for the next month's numbers.
Right, Kyle. I mean, to Kim's point about the core prices doubling to 0.6% here in a month, one explanation here has been that, well, core inflation is really doing okay, so we shouldn't be that concerned, as if Americans perceive inflation as excluding food and energy, right? So that is not how people experience it, even if it was lower. So I think the fact that core inflation is doubling is a particular red flag there. Mitch McConnell was talking not too long ago on the Senate floor here about how he thinks $2 trillion spending bill last March is responsible for as many as 3 percentage points of current inflation. And I think that, you know, you've seen some economists debating that exact effect, but even some Democratic economists willing to say perhaps 2 percentage points. This is a huge contributor to that. The question on gas prices, I think you are also correct on that. We've seen some, maybe some temporary relief, but it's not expected to last. And some of these indicators will lag a little bit behind real time. So I don't see anything in this report that is good news for the Biden administration. I don't see any evidence that inflation is lightening up. It seems like we're in for continuation of its worst level in 40 years.
Well, keep an eye on the prices at the gas pump and at the grocery store, because those might be ahead of the polling as we get toward November. But the big story on Capitol Hill on Tuesday was that the House has voted to allow its aides, its staffers, to unionize. And it passed 217 to 202. Here's a clip from Michigan Congressman Andy Levin, who introduced the resolution, explaining his thought process.
For months now, our workers have been organizing in the shadows because they lack the legal protections to come forward. It should not and does not have to be this way for workers seeking to exercise their First Amendment right to freedom of association, especially here in the halls of Congress.
Kim, what is remarkable about this to me is that we now have a vote to allow these staffers to unionize. But as far as I can tell, nobody seems to understand how this would actually work.
The entire path to this has been a little bit of a comedy of errors. It all began because of an anonymous Instagram account entitled, "What Else, Dear White Staffers," that featured the grievances of a number of unnamed congressional aides. This led to another group of anonymous people starting what they called the Congressional Workers Union to push for this. And it's pretty remarkable how quickly the Democratic leadership folded in the face of this pressure. By February, Andy Levin had introduced that measure. And while Congress is going down this road, what's notable is that the resolution that they passed doesn't say how any of this is supposed to work. And it was purposeful that way. Congress gets to say, yes, you can unionize, but lays out no guardrails. Mr. Levin actually said that he wanted it that way because unionization should be worker driven. But think about how complicated this is. In the House alone, there are 435 separate offices. That encompasses about 9,100 staffers. Each office is allowed to have 18 full-time and 4 part-time staffers. But there are certain numbers of those people who aren't allowed to organize, in particular, anyone who is a manager or in a supervisory role or unpaid interns. So you're going to have a handful of people in each office that each have to have a separate vote on this as to whether or not they'd unionize. There's no clarity on who it would apply to, just junior staff, just senior staff. Would it be different out in field offices versus DC offices? Would these people join an existing union, of which there are a number in Washington, or would they create their own? It's just a complete mess, not to mention the fact that it's highly unlikely that Republican offices will even engage in this, and some Democratic offices may vote it down. So you're going to end up with this patchwork of workplace rules and regulations across all of DC.
But it also strikes me as a strange place to have an adversarial employment relationship, because a lot of these House offices are relatively small and they involve a lot of close collaboration between staffers and the congressman, congresswoman, who is the boss. This is not a situation where you have, you know, factory line employees going in who never see or meet the CEO. You're a legislative aide, and on Monday, you're working on a bill with the congressman, and on Tuesday, are you going to file a labor complaint against him with the National Labor Relations Board, and you're going to do a walkout or go on strike, and then on Wednesday, you're back working on the bill, going for a vote. Kate, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Sure. I mean, to Kim's point, the practical problems are truly endless. For instance, if a group of committee staffers unionized when they were in the majority and then the other party takes power, does the union then follow into the minority, or are the majority now unionizing, or to say they're Republicans and they don't want to be? The headaches are really just endless. There's really no practical way to set this up, in my view. And given that it has been operating in this odd anonymous fashion due to fear of retaliation, we have no idea what the depth of support for it really is in any case. So I think that there's just too many practical problems in that sense to make it really feasible. I would also add that I think it would be the opposite direction of where the House needs to go. Keep in mind, too, it wouldn't apply to Senate staffers. There would be this whole group of people who work in joint House-Senate offices. I mean, it would be a mess. But it would be the wrong direction, I think, because most House offices are set up in the same kind of structure of aides and the same kind of hierarchy. And if you want to retain better talent and pay them a little bit better, we might want to see more experimentation with how House offices are set up. And I think voters are well equipped to decide whether, you know, their House members spends enough staff resources on, say, dealing with constituent casework versus correspondence versus engaging on legislative issues. I think there's an opportunity for more experimentation that might allow for better pay and less turnover, since these jobs tend to be cycling people in and out, which is not always helpful to members of Congress. So I think you want to try to find new models of employment that I think the unionization would preclude that might allow for some of these problems to be solved and some of the employees to be better compensated.
You know, one more point, just to jump in here on the adversarial system that you mentioned, Kyle, is that here's another restraint, and it's not a minor one. Is that federal law puts huge limits on the ability for any of these staffers to negotiate or collectively bargain over key basic things like federal pay, like their pay or, for instance, their benefits, because those are set by statute in that Congress votes every year on how much money there is. And so you begin to ask yourself, why are you organizing and putting yourself in this adversarial position too? Because other than maybe workplace environment, there isn't a ton of stuff that you can necessarily unionize and push for and bargain for, certainly not to the extent that you can out in the private sector.
But that gets to the point where if the House really wants to help these staffers, it seems like the best thing it could do is to give them a raise. And the impression that I get is that in the old days, decades ago, there were a lot more mid-career staffers, experienced staffers, who worked on Capitol Hill for a long time in these aide positions, chief of staff positions. And a lot of that has been supplanted by young people who are coming in and out. And nothing against young people. We were all young people once. But if they really want to get the experienced staff that they need and compete with private sector workers, it's the easy thing to do, I think, is to pay them more. And to that point, Nancy Pelosi has also in recent days said she's going to set a minimum pay for congressional staff of $45,000 a year. And I don't know about the idea of a policy on that, but Kate, it seems to me that Congress ought to have the help that it needs to do the job, to read the bills, to write the bills that are going to govern the country.
I agree with that, Kyle. I mean, I think I don't know that a wage floor in this case will be necessarily helpful. I think members of Congress have recognized this problem as well, and they want to pay their employees competitively and are working within a set of constraints here that may not make sense. Some of these jobs are things that people do for a period of time, and then that skill of having been there and the experience of having been there is then very valuable in post Capitol Hill opportunities that it can be very lucrative. So in some ways, working on the Hill can be deferred compensation, but there are other real opportunities to where you would want to retain people, for instance, who have a long record of experience on how the idiosyncrasies of the chamber works or how certain committees works, where that experience can be really valuable to members. I think that's where it becomes difficult to retain folks. And that's why I think you would want the maximum flexibility you could have to tailor these compensation packages to where you're really struggling to be competitive. So I'm not sure the floor and ceiling approach makes much sense in that regard. I think you want to give members a lot more ability to do what they'd like. But to a certain point, I think you're right that they need probably a larger compensation in general and to review how competitive that package is compared with the next available alternatives that their employees are considering. I don't think we have good information on that yet. So I think that would be a much better place to start than unionization. Would be a review of those budgets and how they have held up over the years.
And I would add that I feel the same way about compensation for members of Congress as well, though it's not a very populist thing to say. Congress, the House, hasn't given itself a raise since 2009. So the pay for a member of the House, I believe, is $174,000. And if you put that into the inflation calculator and go back to the last time they got a raise in 2009, that $174,000 then would be more like $238,000 today. So that is a huge chunk of change that they have not gotten any adjustment upward for. And Kim, if we are trying to lure people who are successful business people, who are successful lawyers, who are getting well compensated outside of government, and we want them to run for the House and we want them to stay in the House and want to be legislators instead of trying to build up a future career as a TV pundit or something like that, it seems like it should be time to give Congress a raise too.
Agreed. And I know I agree with you. That's not a very popular position. And going to work for government should not be a way to get rich. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about luring people, or at least making the idea of public service something that is doable for people, especially younger members, which is what you often see in the House, who are still in the midst of raising families, sending kids to college. You know, those costs can really add up. And then add to it as well that we haven't made public service a very fun thing to do in recent years. The gotcha media that surrounds it, the people constantly trying to go after you on social media, the partisan politics that has just become so ugly. There's a lot of people, a lot of good people that are turned off by that alone, but you add in that they might have to take a real pay cut in order to do it and face all kinds of other very complex, increasingly complex rules and regulations about what kind of outside business they can engage in, etc. That's a real discouragement from people getting on board.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/WashingtonWise.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. One last thought on this unionization piece. Kim, can you give us a sense of why Congress hasn't done this before, why it has taken so long, and maybe part of it is the flip back and forth between parties? Because it seems to me if Republicans take the House in November, by January, we are probably going to have a non-union staff again.
Yeah, we've been talking about the practical problems of making unionization work in Congress. But bear in mind that this all became possible back in 1995 when Congress passed something called the Congressional Accountability Act, which in essence required Congress to abide by a number of workplace rules that existed in the private sector, things like OSHA, for instance. But they had a big debate at the time about whether or not to extend it to unionization, and they decided not to, on a bipartisan decision as well, for a number of substantive reasons. And one of the biggest ones was that there was a big concern that this creates a conflict in that people who belong to unions and who also, for instance, work on issues like labor policy, it increased the potential that unions could have access to confidential information about pending legislation, which is a real issue. There was also a big concern about the degree to which this gave staffers leverage over duly elected representatives, people who are engaged with the people's business. And, you know, while federal workers aren't allowed to strike, it's much more likely when you have unions that you can have sick outs or walkouts, or you could slow roll legislation or bills if you're unhappy with your union work environment, which has real ramifications for the workings of the country. And then there's also the point that we already see this in terms of federal workers in the executive branch, which rubs people a lot of the wrong way. But do we really want to extend the system whereby taxpayers are funding salaries, a significant portion of which are being siphoned off to big labor and big labor's political agenda? So those are all the kind of larger issues that have stopped this from happening in the past.
Finally, there has been speculation since the news that Elon Musk was buying Twitter about whether he would allow President Trump back on, lift the ban on Trump that was instituted after the January 6th riot at the Capitol. And Musk has now removed all doubt about that question. Speaking at an auto summit, he said that Trump would be welcome on Twitter. He called the ban morally wrong and flat out stupid. And listen to this.
It was not correct to ban Donald Trump. I think that was a mistake because it alienated a large part of the country and did not ultimately result in Donald Trump not having a voice. He is now going to be on Truth Social, as will a large part of the sort of the right in the United States, and so I think this could end up being frankly worse than having a single forum where everyone can debate.
Kate, what do you make of this, and particularly the argument that Twitter is a unifying place where political debate can take place, and it would be worse if we end up with a blue social media site and a red social media site?
I think it absolutely would be worse. I mean, the arguments here are rather obvious and everyone makes them, which is, you know, the supreme leader of Iran can have a Twitter account, but Donald Trump can't. It makes the platform look as though they're being selective and punishing certain types of politicians that they don't like. So I think Elon Musk is correct that the only plausible thing to do would be to allow Trump back on Twitter. Whether he would do that or stay on Truth Social is an open question. And it's also an open question, Kyle, whether it would be good for Donald Trump to return to Twitter or whether the public has been enjoying not hearing from him and may remember some of his bad qualities if he returns to the platform. So I am in full agreement that allowing him back on the platform is the only way to restore the platform's credibility as a place to exchange ideas. But I also think, to Musk's point, that it would not be an improvement to have certain chambers where people on the right are gathering to talk and other chambers where people on the left are gathering to talk. I don't think that would make society healthier or less polarized. I do think it is better to abide by the maxim of, you know, more speech can crowd out bad speech, and to allow, you know, all comers on Twitter, with the exception of some extreme cases that you and I have discussed about harassment, incitements of violence, etc. I think in general, Musk's approach here is much better, and that the only thing to really do would be to allow Trump back on.
But what's interesting about his stance here is he's saying that it's a moral stance. And one person who's agreeing with him is Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey. He's saying it was a business decision, meaning to ban Trump. We should always revisit our decisions and evolve as necessary. And Kim, I wonder what you think of that. I mean, I'm less convinced than Elon Musk is about the important social role that he seems to think Twitter plays. I mean, as far as it being a business decision, Twitter's a business. It's an advertising company, and the users are providing free content, and they're also the product because the advertisers want those eyeballs. So what's wrong with Twitter making a business decision?
Well, I appreciate that, and a business decision. I guess the question is whether or not you buy into Musk's argument that there was a certain ethos that existed in Twitter when it was founded that was certainly embodied by Jack Dorsey, things at least at that time. And there's no question that Dorsey seems to be a bit resentful of where the company has gone, particularly in his absence. But that ethos was one that embraced the First Amendment, that this was meant to be a public square. And the ethos was also that it was good business to believe in the First Amendment. I think what Musk is attempting to say is that somewhere along the line, Twitter became full of a lot of progressive activists and progressive elites, and that they were so concerned that Donald Trump's statements might offend that crowd of people that they were willing to alienate half of the country. And that is not necessarily, it was an immoral decision, in Musk's words, and therefore not necessarily great for business. I think that it probably arguably is much better for business to have trust in Twitter. That was one of Musk's point, is that all you do when you have permanent bans is you undermine trust in the platform. If you want to have more users there, there needs to be a belief that it is going to stick to that general free speech ethos. And so I guess we'll see whose business approach is going to work better, assuming that Musk actually takes this over. And he did offer that caveat. He's like, I haven't actually really officially closed the deal yet, so we'll see. I don't get to make these decisions. But we're going to get a real world test of that. And you know, we've certainly argued that in our editorial columns that far preferable to have a CEO who believes that it's good business to promote the First Amendment and wants to try that in the real world than to have Congress come waddling in or regulators and attempt to impose rules from within the Beltway.
Well, I take the point, Kim, that Musk is speaking in some moral terms here, but I think he also does believe that being a more open platform would be a good business decision. I don't think he would have put so much money of his own on the line if he didn't. And we'll have to see if it works. And maybe he will take Twitter public again in a few years, and we'll have to see what the valuation becomes. But thank you, Kim and Kate. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button. And we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.